From the Sunshine State, this is Tampa Bay's 10 Talk.
It's time for FLA Law, brought to you by the personal injury attorneys of Peronic, Caulfield, Averill, and Noyes. This hour will be informative, along with taking your questions and comments. Now, here are your hosts for today's show.
That's right. We are live in the studio with FLA Law, live on the radio. As you know, if you've been listening to us every Tuesday at 5 o'clock, we are the personal injury attorneys of Peronic, Caulfield, Averill, and Noyes. And we always come every Tuesday at 5 o'clock to give you your live legal call-in talk show. Hopefully you've been enjoying it every Tuesday. If you're getting in your car, getting ready to head home from work, don't watch us online, but we are online. We have two streaming platforms that we're on right now that I'm going to tell you about. And then, of course, if you're in your car, you can always listen to us on the radio right now. Of course, we're live in the WTAN studios. You can find us on 1340 AM and 106.1 FM. But if you are still at your desk and you're not leaving for work yet, you can also watch us on Facebook. We are streaming in the studio at Peronic, Caulfield, Averill, and Noyes Injury Lawyers Facebook page. If you have a Facebook account, you can just type in Peronic, P-E-R-E-N-I-C-H. You should be able to find our page. It has a little red circle around the profile picture that lets you know that we are live right now. And you can ask your questions right there in the little comment section in the chat box. And we'll read those out live over the air to get your legal questions answered. But of course, the best and the way that we hope that you call in tonight is through the radio station. So I'm going to give you the number to call in with your legal questions at 727-441-3000. That's the number to the station. That's the number where you can call to speak with myself and my special co-host tonight. I'll give her a second just to say hello in just a moment. But of course, if you don't have Facebook and you're not able to tune in through the radio, you can definitely also tune in through YouTube. So if you're getting ready to step away from your car and you want to keep listening and you don't have Facebook, YouTube is also another way to watch the show. You can watch it on your phone or your device. We are Peronic, Caulfield, Averill, and Noyes Injury Lawyers on YouTube as well. So hopefully one of those ways you can keep watching us through 6 o'clock. It's a 1 hour show. Get your questions in now. The lines are open. Again, it's 727-441-3000. And as I said, we do have my lovely co-host with me tonight. She's been, what's the phrase? Is it my pinch hitter? Multiple times. And she's always got some great legal knowledge for you. My colleague, Lori Robinson. Say hello, Lori.
Very, very happy to join you again, Jacqueline. We always have a good time when we're here.
Yes, we've always, it's kind of become a running theme now where we kind of go over some of the interesting things that are going on in our news and community in regards to various, you know, injury accidents or car accidents and things of that nature. And sometimes it kind of overlaps into various areas of the law. Sometimes it's workers' comp, and the conversation can go in many different directions, so I think it's really enjoyable. I enjoy it, and hopefully our listeners are enjoying the conversation as well. But if you have any questions for Lori and I, feel free to call in tonight. Of course, most of what we talk about tonight is going to be personal injury related, car accident related, and things of that nature. But if you have any other legal questions, feel free to chime in or even comments. I know we had a great caller 1 week who asked us about, you know, city council and trying to get things changed in regard to the crosswalks and the the indicators for people that are visually impaired. I thought that was a really great discussion to have on the air. So don't feel like you have to be limited to what we're speaking about specifically. If you just want to comment on the conversation or you have another topic that you'd like to bring up, feel free. Again, that's 727-441-3000. And again, if you don't want to hear yourself on the air, you can always drop it in the comment section on Facebook. That reminds me, I'm going to go ahead and share our live feed on Facebook while we're talking. But I want to jump into it. We have a few stories here tonight that are personal injury related. And one of them was a little sad I read about. So what I'm going to do is read the articles first, and then Lori and I will kind of comment on them and talk about how it may, the legal implications and how they may apply to what we do. So unfortunately, there was an accident not too long ago in St. Petersburg involving a 2-year-old who was sadly seriously injured as a result of a crash. And the article reads that a crash in St. Petersburg happened on Friday morning, left 4 people hurt, including a 2-year-old who suffered serious injuries around 7:33 in the morning on 41st Avenue North in St. Petersburg. At the time, the car was being driven by a 40-year-old woman who was traveling the opposite direction of a man from Riverview, and unfortunately that car failed to stop at the stop sign, and that's what resulted in the crash. It was basically someone who ran a stop sign. Both drivers were injured, and the woman was the one who was carrying the passenger, which was a 2-year-old child, her son. And the Florida Highway Patrol deemed that the child had been incorrectly restrained in the car. And the car seat ended up shifting during the impact, which led to the child actually being ejected from the vehicle. And so, as you can imagine, he had sustained serious injuries as a result of that. As of the time of this article was written, there were no criminal charges or anything pending as far as that goes. But of course, I wanted to talk about a couple things here because comparative fault has now really changed in our jurisdiction in the state of Florida as it relates to the way we evaluate and look at comparative negligence. And so the first thing that stood out to me was the fact that although mom may not have been at fault for causing this accident, apparently there was an issue with the car seat and whether the child was properly restrained. And so my question becomes, will the parent or the mother have some sort of comparative fault liability when it comes to restraining the child? And maybe we should first explain what the standard is as far as comparative fault.
Sure, because generally speaking, so say something happens as a result of negligence in most settings, and recently they've increased it, the consideration here the Florida legislature has. So let's just take a simple example with the auto accident itself. Now, in this particular case, somebody blew a stop sign.
Right.
So, but let's give a different set of scenarios, a different set of facts, and you have a situation where maybe a driver turns in front of another car,
right,
and arguably does so too close in time to the car going through the intersection.
Sure.
So the argument, and we get this all the time, of course, that
very often,
very, very often there's going to be the idea, well, wait a minute, maybe this person was at fault, and but so was this other person. And so the law...
Maybe they were speeding or changing lanes or something.
Mm-hmm. And so the law does allow and has allowed for consideration of the idea of comparative fault, which would be a percentage of responsibility being assigned, potentially even to any of the drivers. So, so in the example I just gave, let's say that you were arguably going through the intersection too fast, you cut right in front of this other car. Let's say that percentage is greater than 50%. Well, before March of last year, the jury would have been able to assess the percentage of responsibility of fault on everyone involved in the accident, basically.
Right.
Currently, last year, the standards for how you would consider comparative fault changed so that if a person would be found to be more than 50% responsible, then they can make no recovery because
they are more than
50%.
That's
a big change. That's many years ago, longer ago than I was even practicing law, which was 45 years ago. See how quietly she said that. But actually, there used to be a standard in which I can't even remember the terminology for it now as I think about it. But if you had fault, period, you could not recover.
Right.
Then we shifted all the time I've been practicing law to the comparative fault standard,
right,
so that there would be possible to basically apportion it out,
Right.
And then now
according
it's contributing for a fault, I guess is the old terminology. And so now we're kind of shifting back more towards, we're not there yet, but more towards.
Fortunately.
Thank goodness. More towards. Well, if you're more than 50% responsible, then even though somebody else maybe was 45% responsible, which is quite a lot, right? You know,
right.
But you're not going to be able to make a recovery. All right. So now we roll into the situation that you were raising about this terrible accident involving the small child.
Right.
And so there's, let's just say, if we, let's just make it a person, an adult who's in a car,
right,
is injured, and they are not wearing their seatbelt. In that scenario, there is a provision that would allow, if they were ejected from the car and if they've been wearing the seatbelt,
sure,
and it was an operable seatbelt, and could have prevented the injury they had, maybe a head injury or something, then a jury would be able to consider that in terms of damages and,
right,
you know, could even completely reduce the damages. With a child, there are all these complicated requirements now,
yes,
and have been for a long time, about the parent's responsibility,
mm-hmm,
for making sure their child is in an appropriate, proper car seat,
right,
or car or restraint mechanism. And we were talking off the air that it's like, and I was saying, well, Jacqueline, you have young ones, so.
And I should.
You'll know more about this than I would, unless I had a case to study, you know, but.
I still have children in car seats, and I know that obviously it's, for your information, you should always make sure that the weight and the height is appropriate. A lot of children will get to an age where they're like, Mom, I don't want to be in one anymore. But that's not the standard, folks. You have to keep them in a 5-point harness for quite some time until they reach a certain height. And a lot of times, children are also supposed to be rear-facing in a car seat that doesn't even face forward up till almost 3 years old. So again, make sure you understand that. Unfortunately, I don't know the particulars. I can probably look them up right now while we're on the air, but a lot of times the safest methods are not being utilized,
right,
by most parents,
yeah,
because they just don't realize it. They think, oh, my child is old enough, they've outgrown, you know, certain positions, when really they should actually be either rear facing or still in a 5-point harness car seat, or at least a booster.
I was surprised, cause just kind of quickly reviewing it, that it was literally, you know, a child up to 4 feet 9 inches or something,
mm-hmm,
which seems kind of tall,
mm-hmm,
and then 80 pounds. So it's probably a very good idea for everyone on all these kinds of things, if you have young children, to review these things, and that might include, today you can Google stuff, but it might even,
yes,
include a trip to the fire department, which you were sharing.
Yes, that was actually a good point. We talked about it off the air, and I definitely recommend it, because each manufacturer is going to be different. Cars are also going to be manufactured differently, so the way that you install it may vary, and so a lot of people just may not do it quite right. They think it's secure, it feels secure, but it may not be installed properly.
And that sounds like maybe what was happening with the
right,
mother,
so
in this case,
it, because it was in the seat,
because,
yeah,
they weren't saying that the child wasn't in a car seat,
yep,
but that it wasn't properly secured.
Exactly,
yeah,
right.
So in that,
so yes, the fire department can assist with those things if you're just not sure.
And that kind of illustrates this tragedy, how important that would be. Now, in terms of the legal implications,
right,
in many other settings, we would expect that there could be a proportional assignment of responsibility or negligence to the person responsible, which here would be the mother.
Right, that's the question.
But it does turn out, and I was actually surprised, I haven't had this specific question come up before, that in looking at the statute, the law, for, mm-hmm, the requirements, the mother could certainly receive a ticket for not having the child properly secured, but the law actually specifically excludes consideration in a civil action,
right,
of the fact that there wasn't a car seat or a car restraint and that sort of thing. And I'm going to guess that probably the legislative discussions that led to that probably involve what you were just alluding to, that it can be pretty complicated to know,
sure,
exactly how to do it.
Sure.
And if it would seem kind of, yeah, it would seem a little bit tough for a parent, if particularly in this case where the mother was obviously,
sure,
attempting. She probably didn't know that she didn't have,
right,
it properly
maybe
secured.
It wasn't properly anchored. And that's actually a really, really good point, because as you said, you researched it. I had no idea that,
mm-hmm,
that was actually the standard. So that's why I enjoy having you on the show. We learn things together. But I think you're right. There's probably some basis as to why that was done. Just like there's accident report privileges. Certain,
yes,
things just don't come in, and there's reasoning behind it. in this regard, I think that does benefit mom in the sense that she may have honestly felt that she had the car seat installed properly and didn't realize it, or maybe she'd switched vehicles and just wasn't properly secured. So that is actually a really good point to understand. But again, if you are not sure about how things may work, an example, if you're in a situation like the mom where you may have been cited for failing to have that proper restraint, but your child is severely injured, you should not allow that to preclude you from talking to an attorney.
Oh, no, no, no. Right.
Because
Absolutely.
That ticket could deter someone. She did get cited for not mm-hmm. having the proper restraint, but that doesn't mean anything about liability or who was, responsible for causing the accident or who was negligent.
Right. And there might be issues raised mm-hmm. in a legal claim, although based on
sure.
what I looked at today,
sure.
probably that specific one they wouldn't be successful with.
Right.
But they're going to be, in our fact pattern, here's hopefully the driver that blew the stop sign wasn't paying attention. Hopefully there's good insurance there.
Right. And that's the part that we never really know
right.
until they, come into us and we investigate. But that's definitely a situation where I could see someone being deterred and say, well, I got the ticket, and mm-hmm. although my child is severely injured, they may choose not to pursue the incident, thinking that in some way that they were responsible. And I would say this is definitely the kind of case that you want to still
yes.
speak to an attorney about.
No, because there are so many legal implications to virtually everything that happens.
Right.
And as we discuss on the show, I mean, there's just even having practiced law for years, very easy to. Last time I was on here, I was misstating the requirements for when you have to report under your PIP auto insurance. Now, Matt, of course, who was on with me, caught it right away. But it's 14 days, and I was saying 15. I mean, there's so many things. So whenever anything happens,
yes.
I mean, that's one of the great things. You want the opportunity to talk with somebody, and obviously in everything I do with all the years I've been practicing, there's nothing. I'm always reviewing the statutes. I know you do as well. When you're looking at a case and studying mm-hmm. a particular fact pattern, because they're so different.
Right.
I mean, there's so many different things that happen that might, on the surface, seem like they would be
right.
point to one result, and really it's another one.
It could be a totally different result. Absolutely. So while we're talking about a minor child, because obviously in this case, this was a 2-year-old child, mm-hmm. I wanted to touch on a topic that I don't think we've talked about before, which is how pursuing minor settlements are going to be handled. So in instance, let's use, again, this fact pattern that mom does pursue the other mm-hmm. driver, and she's able to find coverage, and it results in a settlement for her 2-year-old son. Obviously, the 2-year-old son cannot enter into a contract.
That's true.
And cannot retain an attorney on his own, so that would have to be through mom. And a lot of people don't quite understand, but certainly seem to get it once we explain it to them as to how minor settlements work and how the funds are going to be handled in the event that it's settled. So, of course, I brought my handy-dandy flowchart here because it's needed. Because it's very difficult to remember all these numbers, as Lori just mentioned, that you can get the numbers all twisted up. But you do have to get approval, right?
Yes. If the settlement, the courts are going to look out for the minor,
mm-hmm.
so a natural parent, I mean, a parent will be the natural guardian of the
Absolutely.
Child and until they reach majority,
mm-hmm.
18. For settlements that are small, which today would be, I think, $15,000 is
sure.
the threshold, anything under $15,000 wouldn't require court approval.
Exactly.
But obviously, what we just are discussing, where a child might have serious injuries, most settlements are going to be above that. So once you
right.
get to a gross settlement of $15,000 or greater, then the court's going to become involved
right.
and approve the settlement and the terms of the settlement.
Now, I think one thing that I may have learned, and it may not be indicated on my flowchart, but I think anytime you file suit, you may have to get approval. Even if it's under $15,000, if you're in suit, I think you may
still
need
approval. Yeah, I'm not positive on that, but you may be right on that.
Because I realize, I think it was a situation that I had a few years back where the settlement was under 15, and we thought we could just wrap it up.
Right.
And I was like, oh, well, no, because it's already in litigation.
Mm-hmm.
We had to still get the approval. Had it been pre-suit, it wouldn't have been needed. So, I don't think that's on my flow chart, but I feel like I actually personally had to deal with a situation like that before. But, yeah, so depending on the level, there's different levels of oversight.
Oh, there you go.
If you
it is on the chart. Court is approval is not required unless civil action filed.
Okay, so it
right
is in
that.
There. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Perfect. So see, we need this flowchart here to go along.
Oh, yes.
So basically, you know, depending on the amount, as the settlement value increases, more steps might need to be taken. For example, if you get all the way over to the 50 or greater, not only do you need legal approval by the court, but you also have to have a guardianship set up, and sometimes that may require a guardian ad litem as well. So the court can have discretion in terms of whether you need a guardian.
Yeah, I was going to say, because once, and I don't remember the level, but it's probably the highest level, definitely has to have the guardian ad litem.
Right. Yeah. So I think the court can waive it according to my little flow chart here, but it is required. But it says may be waived by the court if guardian has no conflict of interest. So I think there's a little bit of discretion there. But people would probably be surprised to know that a settlement that's $15,001 still needs to be approved by the court. Fortunately, you don't need to have legal guardianship or guardian ad litem, but it still needs court approval.
And the court's going to look to see what is the proposal for what will be done with the funds, kind of thing.
That's a good point. So it's not just simply, hey, judge, we settled. Do you mind if you go ahead and stamp your approval? It's actually a pretty detailed petition, and in that petition, you typically have to set forth what happened, what kind of injuries were involved, and give a little bit about the treatment. And then go over the medical bills, the attorney's fees, the costs, and how all that's going to be broken down, and ultimately what the minor child will net. And the judge is going to want to see all that in the petition before they will even consider it. And a lot of times they'll need a hearing before there's even an approval. Mm-hmm. So it's a process involved.
And they're going to be looking at potentially not a smaller amount, but usually, I mean, it's been a while since I've had to do it, but it would ordinarily there'd be something proposed about whether the parent's going to set aside the funds for maybe an educational purpose
or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And then as you get into higher amounts, I think generally you will have to have a guardian ad litem. Now, often, you know, it may be something that the parties can work towards and stipulate to someone to kind of review it. Because the judge, unless there's, you know, a huge amount of money, they're not looking necessarily to create a problem. But if there's enough money, so it really should be set aside, potentially an annuity considered or something like that, or a trust fund that, you know, then those are the things that the court's looking to see that the child is going to be provided for, that the funds that represent a recovery for their benefit are actually going to go to their benefit.
Absolutely right. And typically, I don't do it all that often, but when they are that large, we typically hire help with attorneys that are very experienced in handling the guardianship process.
Uh-huh.
And we, like you said, we stipulate to a guardian ad litem, and they kind of assist in that process for us. So at the end of the day, we can typically handle the smaller settlements, but we want to make sure that the larger ones are being handled properly and the child's being protected and, you know, there's all the good annuities and things of that nature are being put into place. So I think that's also a good way to look at it, as well as if we can get additional help and have outside counsel that is really experienced in that process come in and assist, and that's always great.
Because it's mostly that, and that at that level you're really looking at kind of guardianship type issues.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be, if it's a sizable amount of money, you know, I know there have been situations over the years where maybe the child isn't going to gain access till they're 25 versus 18, or, you know, the different things that are intended to protect the child's the funds. So
that's exactly what it's for. And so a lot of parents sometimes may not understand that it's, although you're the parent, they're under your roof and you provide for them and take care of them, this settlement is for the child.
Right.
And so every now and then we do get parents that just don't quite understand well, you know, I have to pay for the school clothes and the food and everything. Why doesn't it go to me? Well, unfortunately, you know, you weren't the one that was injured, and these, you know, protections are in place for the children. So
right. It's not that the, you know, that the parent may not benefit from these funds in the sense of, if you're talking about things for the children, the child, but it's actually to protect everybody's interest in the long run.
Right.
And so, I mean, you know, a parent, responsibly speaking, of course, doesn't want to do wrong by their child, and so in a certain way, the example I just gave, which I remember 1 year ago that we had, where you don't want a child necessarily getting access to a large amount of money when they turn 18,
right?
Because I remember being 18, you know, I was pretty responsible, but how responsible would I really have been? So so there are protections that can be set up, like I said, staggering when the child gets access to the funds, depending on the individual situation, which actually puts the parent out of the loop. So they're not the bad guy in this scenario. The judge has looked at it and required a certain provisions.
They don't have to be the ones to hold on to the money, that's for sure. I remember even having a situation where I believe we were able to petition, well, I wouldn't say me, the attorney that was handling the guardianship was able to petition the court because the mom wanted to put the daughter into a better, like a private school, and she wanted to try to fight for that so that some of the funds could be allocated towards that, and I believe they were successful in getting that done. So many different you know, factors do come into play when it is a settlement involving a minor child. There are legal, you know, guardianships and court approval that needs to happen during that process. So hopefully that was a good a tidbit of information for you. I don't think we've talked about that before. So, of course, if you have any questions about that, the lines are open. The number is 727-441-3000. Feel free to give us a call. You can also drop us a question in the Facebook comment section. I see we have a few viewers. Thanks for watching. Feel free to like, share, repost, let your friends and family know that we are live on the air. We've got another half an hour. You can call in, ask your legal questions. We're going to take a quick break just to go to a commercial. And at that time, we'll come back and we'll talk some more about some of these current events.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
In 1955, the law firm now known as Peronick, Caulfield, Averill, and Noyes made a decision. Instead of taking whatever cases came through their doors, they decided to focus specifically on personal injury. 64 years later, the law firm is one of Clearwater's longest-running personal injury firms. Available 24 hours a day with offices in Clearwater and throughout Tampa Bay, they're ready to put decades of experience to work for you if you or a loved one has been injured in a car accident or injured due to someone's negligence or recklessness. If you feel overwhelmed, uncertain, or unsure about your next steps after being involved in an accident or after a loved one sustained serious injuries due to someone else's negligence, call Peronick, Caulfield, Averill, and Noyes at 727-796-8282 or online at usalaw.com. That's 727-796-8282 or online at usalaw.com. Non-attorney spokesman.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
And we are back from the break. This is FLA Law live on the radio. And as you know, this is your live legal call-in talk show. I am here with my co-host, Lori Robinson. My name is Jacqueline Bryan. As you know, we're the personal injury attorneys at Peronick, Caulfield, Averill, and Noyes. And we have been talking this show about some personal injury-related current events that have occurred either in Tampa Bay area or around the state, that we kind of go over what happened and then talk about how the law might apply in these cases. And so if you have any comments or questions about what we're talking about, feel free to call in. The number is 727-441-3000. If you have another issue or some other legal question that you'd like us to answer, Lori and I are also here to answer that as well. Again, we are streaming on Facebook and YouTube. Feel free to comment or leave a question in the chat box, and we will answer that live on on the air as well. So we are just going down the list here, Lori, to our next article. This was last week, I believe, the construction crane incident that happened down in Fort Lauderdale. Eerily reminded me, of course, the Baltimore bridge incident that just happened not too long ago. I think the last show that you and I did together,
I think you're right.
It happened that day. And so we talked about that sad incident involving the boat crashing into the bridge. Well, in this situation, it happened in downtown Fort Lauderdale, where a construction crane collapsed and fell onto the bridge. It also fell onto two vehicles, unfortunately, there was a construction worker who was killed in the process, and there were two people that were also injured. So I'm just going to briefly, this article's a little long, I'm just going to kind of skim through, hit the high points for our listeners so they understand what occurred. Apparently, downtown Fort Lauderdale, there was a section of construction that was going on, and apparently they were working on a building and were in the process of stepping the crane, and I didn't quite understand what that means, but apparently stepping the crane is where it allows the crane to elongate as the building as the building gets taller. As they continue to work on it, they step it up and make it larger. Well, apparently during that process, the fire chief in Fort Lauderdale stated that the platform that was holding it up apparently fell, and a section of that tower crane came down. Apparently, during the fall of the crane, one of the workers fell along with it, and it came down on, I think, a Tesla vehicle that was driving on the bridge, and another car as well. Fortunately, those individuals did not die, but they were unfortunately injured. From what I understand, it says that or does not mention the name of the company, so we don't know who owns the construction crane or what building they were working on, so that part we don't really know. But it was a nearby condominium of some kind that they were working on, and the officials are still investigating. It looks like, let's see. Yeah, it says they could not reach the construction company's division manager, so they didn't have a comment from that individual.
They'll probably be very careful on commenting.
Yeah.
Because that's a mess with a lot of possible issues related to individual liability for companies.
Fortunately, it says that the FDOT did investigate. Doesn't feel that any other buildings surrounding it were impacted, and those buildings are safe. Because that, of course, could make it a whole lot worse. Because it also reminds you of that one condo collapse as well down in South Florida. So it just brings up a lot of different issues. So with that being said, obviously there was a death of an individual who was working on for the construction companies. There were two persons that were injured that were apparently traveling on the bridge. From what we understand, the platform of the construction crane failed. Where's the case here? Is there any liability that we can find?
Oh, I think there'll be a lot, but it won't be obvious to us in this moment, but the investigations that will occur, obviously there'll be OSHA investigations and that sort of thing, governmental investigations, but from just the first level, the poor gentleman that was killed, there will be, it's obviously a workers' comp claim.
We touched on that before.
So they'll,
we can of course remind our listeners how that kind of comes into play and the benefits for.
So when you're injured in the course of your work, you're really, your legal remedies are within the administrative workers' compensation system. There is a $150,000 death benefit if the person dies, and in a situation like this, that won't be an issue, I'm sure. There can be situations not against your employer. So if you know, under workers' comp, if your employer has been negligent, really somehow hasn't done what they should do, you don't have the option to sue your employer. But right. in many situations like this on large construction sites, they're all different companies out
exactly.
there.
Exactly.
And so depending on what's happened, there may well be a possibility of what we would call a third-party claim,
right.
a regular negligence claim against some other company.
That's what we'd be looking for.
Right,
yeah.
yeah that. Because one thing for sure, there was negligence here.
Yes.
These things don't just happen like that
right.
without something having occurred that should not have happened.
Absolutely. And so, and that's the main thing that we would be looking for, I think, for the failure in the platform. And is that entity the same as the construction company mm-hmm. that this individual is working for, which doesn't sound like it would be. And that's who we'd want to kind of be looking at for a case like this, is who's responsible for the crane? Was it the some other manufacturer?
Right.
Or where did the failure come from? And it sounds like, in my opinion, that it probably would be a third-party claim that the family of this individual would be able to pursue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Would certainly be, as you always point out, obviously anything with significant damages
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
is always worth reviewing with a lawyer that handles personal injury matters, because these particularly these workers' comp situations, they're very complicated. They do require often quite a bit of investigation, but that doesn't mean that you don't turn up something.
Exactly. Right. And so these other individuals, like this man, Mr. Mark Carrizan, he was driving in a Tesla, and he said he just had a feeling that something was coming, and he slammed on his brakes, and sure enough, this big, huge, massive piece of blue steel fell into his car. So the drivers that are driving across the bridge would not be the same as the construction worker in that
right.
sense, as far as
they should
their liability. Yeah.
Bring a claim against the company, presuming that you can show negligence, which
mm-hmm.
we're going to presume. Yeah, it kind of depends on what happened here, really.
Right.
I mean, what company was responsible for the maintenance and operation of that crane.
Right.
Definitely would expect that there would not be the workers' comp immunity issue that we always struggle with in settings, because it can seem very unfair, you know, if you are injured in the course of your employment, and there are situations where employers have actually, you know, really been, really terrible. They've been negligent.
Absolutely.
You know.
I agree.
And yet, because of the law, you're not permitted to bring a claim against that employer. You know, you have to go within this administrative system, which is very limited, actually.
It is.
You
quite,
know?
Quite more limited than most people would assume. So when there is a third-party claim, that opens up the door, of course, for much more damage
right.
to be
because
pursued.
Because, as we've talked about in the past, the damages within a workers' comp claim are really nuts and bolts kind of things. They are medical care,
mm-hmm.
but you go to a workers' comp authorized doctor.
Right.
They have agreements with them. They are paid under a workers' comp fee schedule, which
mm-hmm.
is very much less than even your health insurance
right.
pays. You know, so.
One of my favorite mediators says they're not getting paid Macy's rates; they're getting paid Big Lots rates.
that is true, you know. So you have the right to your medical care and then wages, but that's a calculation under the workers' comp system.
Mm-hmm.
That ends up being 66 2/3 of your average wages, basically, but it's capped. I mean, I have a client that I was talking to who has made pretty good money, but the maximum comp rate, I think it might be up to $1,100 this year,
mm-hmm.
but it's, you know,
mm-hmm.
And that's, so 66 2/3 of whatever you're making could be more than that, but
right.
it'll be limited to
it's
that.
It's going
to
be capped at that
and
amount.
Most
yeah.
people will be within the caps anyway, but it's very, very limited, and nothing for pain and suffering
yeah.
whatsoever.
All the things that matter the most to a lot
mm-hmm.
of people, it's just not compensated for under workers'
right.
comp, that's for sure. So the individuals that were driving on the bridge may have a much better remedy, assuming that the construction worker couldn't bring a workers' comp, a third-party claim, but hopefully
right.
he can. So that was the main idea that I wanted to discuss
mm-hmm.
about this accident. But one of the drivers whose car was hit mentioned a great point too. He said, who's inspecting these buildings? Are there any inspections that are going on, especially relative to the amount of buildings that are out here? So he asked a really good question, and I think the investigations will start to determine that. Like you said, there's going to be quite a bit of different agencies and departments that are going to investigate
but
this.
But one thing that's a big surprise to people and to those of us lawyers as well is that, let's say it's the government falling down on the job.
Oh, yes. That's a good conversation.
Yeah, that's a totally different thing. So, you often look at building code violations, things like this. You can't sue the government for basically failing to do what they should be doing. Yeah. You can sue them if you're in an auto accident with them.
Planning versus what's the...
Planning and operations versus, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So however many inspectors they have, that's something that's a planning level decision. Mm-hmm. And you are in a position where if that individual doesn't do a good job, that we're going to be able to sue. Because, of course, and it's pretty easy to understand the rationale here, because if we could sue the government for all of the mistakes they make and the negligence that they demonstrate over and over again and how they make their plans and even perform their operations, well, we put them out of business, and we can't do that.
The government would go bankrupt, that's
so
for sure.
That's the theory behind it, and there's some logic to it. Yeah,
right. That's a really good point. So if it turns out that some of these failures fall on government entities, then that does bring up a big issue for whether or not there can be claims that
well
can
the
be
inspection
made.
Failures, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. the fact that that crane, that crane being operated in a construction, I mean, something must have occurred there. Mm-hmm. But there wouldn't be an additional avenue to go after
for failing to inspect.
For the government entity, but the government's investigation of all of this will certainly turn up, I'm sure. Probably pretty much what occurred.
Yeah, this will be quite interesting to see, as I said about the Baltimore Bridge incident as well. As we know more and as we learn more, it'll be interesting to see where the failures were and how it'll shift the way things are done moving forward. And that's always the hope, is there'll be a positive change in the way we currently do things.
That is a great hope. All the years I've been doing personal injury, it's been kind of disappointing to see how a few times things change. But if there wasn't a legal system that could hold companies and people accountable, there wouldn't be any hope that it would change.
Exactly, certainly
in areas like this, I would be surprised if there weren't some changes that came out of the terrible situation I was talking with a friend of mine about the situation in the with the ship, and he was explaining, he was in the Navy, and he was saying, they come in there with these huge ships. And they let the tugs go pretty quickly, and then if something happens, they can't control the ship. And so he was.
Some insight on how very little control they
and
really
so
have.
And how you could see where there probably would be changes that could be made to try to be a little more careful and supported in what happens. Because that was just something he'd been on Navy ships in his career in the past, so he had an opinion about how it might have even happened. So, hopefully there'll be some positive changes there, and there could be.
That's always the hope, and that's always part of the policy argument as far as why we do what we do. It reminded me the other day, I was a little offended. I don't know why, because I don't even do class action lawsuits, but I was listening to one of my favorite radio stations. It's like a Christian, contemporary Christian station, and the topic was about these class action lawsuits, how you kind of get these in the mail every now and then.
Oh, yes.
It's like big company did something bad, and if you were impacted, you might be entitled. And it's usually something small that you get, because there's so many so many claimants that they can't obviously pay everybody a lot of money. You end up getting a check for $5 or something like that. But the comment was made that, you don't get anything, and the lawyers just get rich, and these things are pointless. And I thought, if that's the case, then how do we hold these companies accountable for doing the bad thing that they're doing, whether it's deceptive charges or, I think one of the cases was about these basically just a junk fee. They were adding fees for no reason to individuals' bills. And if you fell in that class, then you were entitled to be reimbursed for those fees that you should have never been charged. And you think about, well, if these suits don't exist, then how will they ever be regulated? How will it ever stop?
It'll never stop.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to comment that on the radio.
I agree. Because if people, I mean, even as lawyers, we might look at it sometimes askance. But the truth is, the whole class action system is designed for there to be an incentive for lawyers that handle cases of that nature to pursue things that are actually legal wrongs.
Yeah,
you know, that, I mean,
absolutely.
It has to be something.
Absolutely.
So go ahead, fill out that card and get your $5.
Exactly.
It's a matter of principle.
That's exactly right. So we are going to move on to our next article while we have just a few minutes left in the show. Of course, if you are going to call in, this would be a nice time to do it because we want to make sure we have plenty of time to answer your questions. Don't delay because we only have about 10 minutes left on the show and we want to be able to answer your question. If you've been listening to what we're talking about and something came to mind, call 727-441-3000. Get your question in or else you'll have to wait all the way until next week. We don't want that. So while we're waiting for people to call in, we do have some more articles I want to touch on. Let's see, we've got two and I want to see which one I think might be a better conversation. Let's talk about the red light runner. So there was a case that happened not too long ago in St. Pete where an individual kind of in not quite downtown St. Pete had ran a red light and actually caused a three-car pileup. So according to St. Petersburg Police Department, there was a BMW that was traveling on 34th Street and ran a red light at Central Avenue. Then a black Mercedes and a Nissan Rogue were driving in the opposite direction. They both hit this vehicle at once. So it almost they kind of T-boned the car. So there's three vehicles involved. That impact actually caused the Mercedes to roll over, land on top of the BMW. Both vehicles veered off to the side of the street and struck a 49-year-old man that was standing on the corner.
Wow.
The police say that the pedestrian was actually pinned under the wreckage.
Oh my gosh.
And had to be freed by the first responders. And so the reason why I pulled this article is because we have an individual who's running a red light. You've got cars coming from all different directions, hitting a vehicle, rolling over, pinning the pedestrian. You can imagine how there may be some dispute about who did what.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Whether they're... Did I have a red light? Did you have a green light? You understand how that happens in the cases that we represent. And so I wanted to talk about proving liability and what's the best way to go about preserving evidence, right?
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on that? Because this article doesn't say anything about there being a red light camera or somebody was able to verify it. They just said that he ran a red light. So I don't know how they confirmed that, but sometimes we don't have anything. We don't have video. We don't have a witness. And so what can we do in these kinds of cases?
So, you know, we'll start, so say someone consults with us or with an attorney, regardless. The start is often the traffic accident report.
Yes.
And we'll see. And so, you know, the police officer will have interviewed witnesses on the scene and come to some conclusion.
Hopefully.
Yes. Not always, but, you know, he probably tried or she tried with an accident like that.
Right.
But, of course, it doesn't really... It'll tell you something, and someone might have even gotten that ticket, the person, you know.
Right.
But as we probably have discussed at various times on the shows, that in and of itself is not something that will ever be admitted into evidence in court because the police officer doesn't actually know.
Right.
You know, unless the officer saw the
accident.
Unless
the officer was sitting there and actually viewed the accident when it occurred.
So that'll be a start. Any witnesses that were identified, and then, we will always send an investigator out with the information we have and to go to the local areas because we always look to see if there might be some sort of surveillance video and, you know, that sort of thing.
Exactly. And this particular, just using this fact pattern, I think it said it was on Central Avenue and 34th Street in St. Pete. That's a pretty busy intersection. There's quite a few businesses there. I think there's a gas station. There's a Walgreens. It's near where that I forget the name of that plaza, but there's a big shopping center there. So there could be a number of cameras that might have captured this incident.
And there could be even in situations, that's a bad accident, that would have drawn a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. So you might even luck out and actually find some witnesses by just talking to neighboring businesses and that sort of thing. Yeah,
you're right.
Yeah, so that would be the start, certainly, to try to sort out what happened, because that's very important.
Very important. That's why when you have an incident like this where there's multiple vehicles involved, potentially multiple people that could have been injured, you want to hire an attorney right away so that the investigation can begin. People don't always realize that if there is video, sometimes it's not maintained or preserved long.
Right.
And so some of these businesses, they're not there to preserve the evidence.
No.
They're trying to prevent theft or protect their property. The cameras are there for security reasons, not necessarily to capture the evidence of an accident. And so if you don't move swiftly, sometimes it's not saved. They don't always have DVR systems that, you know, will hold the videos for very long. So it's very important to act quickly. And a lot of times people think, well, you know, isn't there a red light camera there, or there's a camera at that intersection? Sometimes those cameras do not record. A lot of them are capturing live feed, and they will only capture if you run the red light.
Right, they'll capture your license plate.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, so,
but,
you know, that you might get a screen grab of a license plate, but you won't actually see what happened.
Right, I don't know how effective that, but you obviously it'd be something that would be pursued to see.
You definitely want to look into it, but I found a lot of times when I look at the intersection cameras, or I try to get cameras from the actual traffic lights themselves, I'm always, I won't say always, but I tend to be told that they don't record.
Mm-hmm.
They're not actually recording. You can get a live feed of what's happening at that time, but it's not actually recording, so they can't go back to a specific date and find the incident. And I think a lot of people are shocked by that. Like, I know there's a camera. I saw that camera on that traffic light, but it unfortunately does not record a lot of times. So, but that's right. Looking for our witnesses, making sure we're capturing the videos and preserving them whenever we can. Sometimes, and I got lucky at once before where someone witnessed it. They did not stay at the scene, but they called it in to 911, said, hey, I just saw a really bad car accident. We were able to get the 911 call sheets.
Very good.
And we're able to track down that individual.
Mm-hmm.
That way, it took a lot of sleuthing.
Yes, I'm sure it did.
But we got it. And so there's a lot of different and creative ways we can try to track down and prove how did this accident happen and how are they going to be held responsible.
Mm-hmm.
We are winding down on our time, but I wanted to make sure that we don't leave the show without talking about you. We've got 2 minutes. In the event that these accidents result in not being able to find coverage, you want to make sure you have coverage of your own. We've talked about some very strange scenarios tonight.
Yes.
And you never know what that other driver may or may not have that has caused an injury to you or your family. Check your policy. Make sure you have uninsured motorist coverage. If you're not sure, give us a call at the office, 727-796-8282. We'd be happy to review your policy for you to help you understand what you have, what you don't have, and what you might want to add to it. With that being said, Lori, it's been a great show, as always.
Always enjoy
being
on the air with you.
We didn't get to go through all our articles, but I'm sure I can save them, and we'll talk about them next time
when
you're on the air.
Next time we have Jackie and Lori on the air.
Exactly. So next week it'll be myself and my partner Brian Caulfield, and of course he's also a wealth of knowledge. That'll be a great show for you as well. Thank you for tuning in. As always, every Tuesday at 5 o'clock, we'll be back with FLA Law on the radio to answer legal questions next week. So give us a call next week at 5, and we'll see you next week. Take care.